they'll point their heads forward, their noses forward, and sort of stretch and snake their heads forward sometimes with their ears pinned back. And that's language. Pretty clear, you know, but sometimes it's so subtle that it really takes a lot of practice to understand that as much as a horse might look like she's doing what you're asking, she is really flipping you the bird. So.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. I've wanted to do a series on horses for a while. Horses played such an outsized role in human history. All you have to do is look at a horse and imagine the difference between having to move everything on foot, or with a cow or a donkey, or imagine what it must have been like when humans learned to ride horses. Horses led to the earliest form of globalization, and there's a theory that they were responsible for the spread of Proto-Indo-European. That's the mother language of Indo-European languages, everything from English to Russian to Hindi to Urdu. They've been at the center of many human cultures, from the Mongolian riders who conquered territory from Eastern Europe to China, to medieval knights in Europe to the horses of the American West. They're deep in our cultural DNA. So I recorded an interview with anthropologist William Taylor about the earliest history we know about, and particularly about the domestication of horses. But before I share that with you, I wanted something more immediate. After our last episode on David Abrams' book, The Spell of the Sensuous, in which my guest Trevian Stanger and I discussed Abrams' model for understanding our relationship with the natural world as one of an embodied, sensual engagement, it seemed appropriate to begin my series on horses with a story of one human animal and one horse animal. So I reached out to a close friend I've known since we were in high school together. Jennifer Lynch Fitzgerald lives in Clarksville, Georgia. She's an acupuncturist, an herbalist, and an animal lover. She rescued her dog Gloria from Mexico. She has several cats, each with a distinct story of how they came into her life, and a rescue horse named Maddie, a Mustang. Mustangs are quintessentially American. Though the ancestors of the modern horse, and indeed all horse-like species, evolved in what is now the United States, they went extinct in North America roughly 10,000 years ago. Some escaped over the Bering Ice Bridge and continued to evolve in Europe and Asia. Horses were then reintroduced to the Americas by the conquistadors in the 15th and 16th centuries. And Mustangs are descended from these Spanish horses, though they mix with numerous other breeds over the years. Having started out as domesticated horses, they escaped into the wild. They were prized by American indigenous people, rounded up by cowboys. And today, the Bureau of Land Management oversees roughly 86,000 free-ranging Mustangs in Nevada, California, Oregon, Utah, Montana, and Wyoming. Maddie started out her life as one of these. I asked Jen to tell me her story, beginning with how Maddie came into her life.
Well, she was kind of dumped on me, honestly. Really, I was invited to horse sit. I had some friends who were getting ready to go on vacation, and they'd never had a vacation since they had all these horses. In retrospect, I realized that they were desperate that they would have somebody so inexperienced do that. But I agreed to feed and check a couple times a day and got just kind of a crash course in how to handle them and how to take care of them in one day. And then I took care of these horses for a week. And after that week, the owner approached me and said, Maddie and the other horse, her name was Little Creek at the time, they had both been adopted from, well, adopted is really a stretch. They were bought for like $5 at the auction because a group of horses locally in my county, in Habersham County, Northeast Georgia, had been seized by the state for cause, and Maddie was among them. And this guy who had all these horses, I think there were like 100, and only two of them were Mustangs. and they were adopted in this case. They were scooped up because they were Mustangs, because the woman who gave her to me has a personal interest in Mustangs. Anyway, this whole group of horses had been collected and they were headed for the feedlot in Canada. So they were in really cramped quarters. They were really underfed and they were destined to become meat themselves. And somebody reported them and they all got seized. So anyway, they all got rehomed, all of them who were healthy enough to do that. And so Maddie was only probably like a year and a half at that point. So I got her really young and really pissed off, really mad, really outraged about her scenario.
Had she been ridden at all or was she just? No.
No, she was. We don't, in the form of training I do, they don't call it breaking a horse, but some people do. But she hadn't really been much gentled at all. Like, evidently, there were four or five guys trying to trailer her. And when they got her, and nobody could get her in until Abby came. So the method that she does is called progressive horsemanship. And it really relies on an agreement between the horse and the human that, like, okay, I respect you. I'll protect you. Let's do it.
So when did you meet her and what was that like?
When I met Maddie?
Yeah.
She didn't stand out to me. I confused her with the other horses.
Yeah.
I couldn't really tell that much of the difference between them. It's embarrassing now, but just initially with the unpracticed eye, it's just like, oh, they're all kind of brown, black. She was the only black one, but I didn't really figure her out at all. And she's very small for a non-miniature horse. She's not a pony, but she's only 13 hands. So she's pretty diminutive. And the other horses were totally different from her, but I didn't pay attention. She was just another one. And I ended up choosing her over the other horse who was available because she is super feisty. And I could tell at least after a week of playing with her a little bit that she's super feisty. Yeah.
So do you know where she came from originally?
Nevada.
Okay. So was she on public land, do you know, or?
No. On the range out west, I think the fencing is inconsistent. So she would have been rounded up because she was on cattle owner's land, which is subsidized by the Bureau of Land Management. It's beautiful that they adopt them out. It's part of what works, but also ranchers are incentivized to raise cattle out there. So these wild horses are in competition with the cattle. That's why they get scooped up.
Right.
And adopted out.
Land. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wonder what happened so that all these horses were kind of neglected. It sounds like somebody had a whole bunch of them.
So when the BLM puts them up for adoption, these horses need to be retrieved. So it's not like they're shipped all over cost-free. If somebody wants to adopt a Mustang, either that person drives to an adoption location. And in this case, that probably is what would have happened 13 years ago. She's going on 13. So somebody fetched her, but how she got to this holding situation in Georgia is a different story. The guy who picked her up was driving around Georgia offering to take horses off people's hands if they couldn't handle them or if they looked old and sick. He really was a scoundrel. But his story about her is memorable because she's my horse, but also because Abby is my trainer. She's, according to her, she was the maddest horse that she's ever encountered, like just on first approach, and stands out because she turned around her attitude so much. She was really, really mad and nobody could work with her forever because she had been tied to a tree on a really short line for like months, supposedly, this guy said.
Oh, man.
So she went from a bad situation to this lot where she was, you know, starving. So yeah, she had a bumpy start and nobody knows what happened before that. They are branded on their necks. So all Mustangs have a brand on the left side of their neck and the brand indicates where they're born and when they're taken in, or if they were born in captivity, rather. So when they are taken into captivity and where. So she would have been very young no matter what, but she was not born in captivity.
So tell me about how you developed a relationship with her, how you learned to work with her so that she could trust you.
Well, I did it probably all backwards and wrong. But ultimately, that's probably how it's worked out so well. I had only been living here in Georgia and starting my practice, my business, for like a year and a half, maybe not even that long. And I was in the middle of a breakup, and a lot of things were upside down in my life when I took this on. So it didn't make any sense that I did. So I bring that up to say that I was not feeling very solvent, and it costs money to support a horse, to board them and feed them. And particularly Mustangs need a certain kind of management. Their native terrain is totally different from here. They're adapted to a really dry environment, and here it is humid and lush and easy for them to founder or colic because there's so much more grass here and, you know, so much more to eat. So where I'm going with this is that she was basically unschooled, just very minimal. You know, we could handle her. I just couldn't handle her very well, you know, get a lead rope on her and stuff like that. But I agreed to start working on a weekly basis with a trainer. But I told her, because I was feeling so broke, that I wanted to learn to train her myself, as opposed to give her to a trainer and have her do the gentling process, get her rideable, get her saddle broke, as they say. So instead, I went at it and I did these weekly lessons with marginal success. Like, I got to a certain point, but eventually I did have to give her to my trainer to really take the huge leaps that I could see. But a lot of my training involved this, certainly learning technique on a lead. This whole practice is not so much about eventually riding. I mean, it's fabulous to ride, but the way it unfolded for me is that it became clear that relationship is the whole thing. So whether she was going to be kind of a pasture pet, which she is right now, I'm not riding her much right now at all, due to some injuries and because of the extra busyness of my life right now. But she shows this, and showed from the very beginning, this curiosity, like that feistiness. She's interested in spite of being so wounded, and showed that from the very get-go. And a lot of horses don't show that. So when I say how I went about it is kind of misguided, I really went for this one technique. I kind of crave to do it still. It's what you do is I take her into the ring, and it needs to be really a round ring, and take her off lead. And when we approach it, it's more as a remedy when we can't get anywhere with a horse on the lead. Like, we're asking to do work. We're asking for give and take. And maybe the ears are always being pinned, or she's pretending she can't follow, more attitude than anything. You take them off lead and then send, like, spin the lead rope at her and have her take off, and then tell her to go the other direction. So start giving her direction from off lead. And it's kind of aggressive. It's kind of harsh. It's not making contact with her. You know, I might hit the lead on the ground and get big and kind of scary looking to her, but it really is like, we agreed that I'm in charge in this moment. I'm sending you this way, go this way, go this way. She has to get all outraged and ticked off. And eventually the strategy is to help them break through that indignation and rebelliousness and change their mind. Like, you can see it happen in a flash where the dynamic is that, for example, like, I would be going after her, kind of saying, go this way, now go this way, go this way, go this way. And then suddenly drop my energy, which is part of what I learned to do. I did not do it well. And then kind of back up and lean away a little bit and invite her to come toward me. And if she chooses to do that, then she's choosing relationship. And it's just this brilliant moment. So I feel like, even though that's kind of a rough way to start, and it really belongs in the toolbox of somebody who's experienced and skillful. I did it when I was totally inexperienced, but I saw the magic happen with her where she's like, yeah, I want relationship. Like, I want to connect.
Was there a particular moment where you started to feel on your end that relationship start to develop? Like, where you started to feel like, she's my horse, like, there's a connection here?
Well, I didn't entirely trust it for years, I would say. This sounds kind of sad, but I faulted myself for not being more committed and not investing more time. And it's a fair amount of time, but I think I recognized early on that I didn't grow up wanting to ride horses. I might have romanticized a little bit, but it's not something I pursued. I'd want to engage with horses like I want to engage with dogs and cats, you know? But not like horses on the walls, posters, and, you know, so I felt like I didn't come in with the hunger that many people do. And I observed how much obligation was a part of this. Like, it's just a lot of work. And I had a lot going on. So anyway, what I imagined was that she must see me just as, you know, just another one of the people that handles me and feeds me and asks me to do stuff. But after she went and lived with Abby, my trainer, and was trained, I got more feedback from other people that she would kind of get like sort of lit up and turned on when I would come around. But I still didn't really buy it until she moved to a barn away from there where she had to get to know a whole nother set of circumstances. And then I saw her run across the field for me. That shifted something in me, honestly. Because I think I have felt like her steward and a responsibility from that end, but I assumed because their languages are different from ours. I didn't expect her to turn into a puppy or something like that, but they look indifferent a lot. And having her warm up to me over time has made her appear different from that. Also, I can say, and this is, it's sort of painful, but I can't remember if it's 2019 or 2020, but it might have been fall of 2020. But she got an injury to her fetlock, right front fetlock. And we had to stall her for 6 weeks. And to do that to a Mustang is huge. They're not built for it at all. No horses. They are obligatory travelers to make their GI work, to make their consciousness work right. So to put her in a stall and just walk her twice a day for 10 minutes to try to heal this is by far the most sort of trust building exercise we've ever had. And she was mad, but she put up with it, and she clearly showed that she trusted me to handle this, even though it wasn't what she would have wanted. And when I let her go, she was as healed as she was going to get from this. And I was given the go-ahead from a vet to put her out to pasture and let her just deal with it. And when I did that, she went bonkers. Like, she ran and ran and ran, and it was gorgeous. We were all crying. It was so beautiful. And then everybody walked away, and I stayed out there and kind of squatted down to watch her. And she turned around and looked at me and came back and gave me a little nuzzle on the nose. It was just a Hallmark movie. and then took off. It's like she really seemed to show me some kind of understanding or forgiveness or something. And it was incredible.
That sounds like it.
Moment. Yeah.
When you say the language of horses is different, can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how would you describe it?
Well, for example, what looks like aggression to us is really just direction between them, you know, nipping, or they push each other. And it's usually about resource dominance. I wouldn't call it, maybe there would be resource guarding if there was only a limited resource, but even like around some bales of hay. They'll push each other around dominance, and it looks unfriendly, but it's mostly just clarity. And their language has everything to do with their conformation and body movement, body orientation. So pinning their ears back shows displeasure or aggression. They'll point their heads forward, their noses forward, and sort of stretch and snake their heads forward sometimes with their ears pinned back. And that's language. Pretty clear, you know, but sometimes it's so subtle that it really takes a lot of practice to understand that as much as a horse might look like she's doing what you're asking, she is really flipping you the bird. So, you know, she's like, I'll do this and screw you. So, and then of course, when the ears come forward, like perking up and listening, there's some attentiveness and care, softening around the eyes and the face. But there's also this way that they, unless it is around food and rewards or affection, another kind of reward, usually a horse will give a person a lot more space than we think we want. Like if my horse snuggled up to me and put her, I'd be thrilled if she put her head on my shoulder, you know, and just wanted to be close. But she wants to be close for a minute. And if it's more than that, then she wants something from me and she's not respecting my space. So proximity just says everything about what their agendas are and what they're trying to get from the situation. So it kind of, it sounds, they could be manipulative like people, of course, but it's just a lot more black and white with them, I think. Also, matter of fact, you know, they kind of come in for information and then they go on, but it doesn't mean they don't like us. They're just doing their thing.
I was struck by your use of the word orientation. In the beginning, you said a lot of it has to do with body and their movement, which makes a lot of sense. If you see packs of horses, if you watch them interacting in the wild, which I haven't done in person, only on video, but there's so much movement happening, right? And they're taking cues from each other and they're operating within this much bigger landscape. So that's interesting. I'm curious if, you know, your relationship with Maddie, you have a relationship with a number of animals in your life, if that has influenced in some way or made you more aware in certain ways of your own physical being in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Because, well, with interaction between horses and humans, the whole time my body language is impacting her. You know, how I walk through a herd of horses is impactful. There are so many ways to do it. And even to walk, if they're ignoring me and at the barn where Maddie lives, there are only three now, but the three of them might be having at the hay and busy and not showing me any mind. But if I walk past them to the barn in a way with big energy, they're gonna change dramatically. So that requires that I be mindful, of course. And when we're working together where I'm looking for a certain outcome or an exploration, all of my body language is, it's the meat of the whole thing. So how I do anything is much more important than what I do and what I'm feeling during that behavior. For example, if I'm angry, on one hand, I can do my correction in a way that communicates my anger, you know, by getting big or harsh or even something that's not necessary to just let her know I'm pissed. But on the other hand, I can feel my anger, rein myself in a minute and get just really matter of fact in my movements and my contact with her, get really minimalist. And that is much more effective than anger. That awareness is a long cultivation for me. I have not been able to show that much restraint historically in my life. So this skill set, which I don't always have access to, but I usually have access to around the horses, this translates into the rest of my life with other creatures and with other human creatures. Every day, I truly think about this as informed my personal practice, when I teach yoga, when I'm in the treatment room with people, when we're going to have a session, how I come in and how I make my body bigger or smaller or come closer or further away. I see very much how much even facial expressions impact other animals, even animals that don't appear to read facial expressions. The horses don't pay attention to our faces that much, but incline the head a fraction, something totally different can happen.
Hmm. Do they smell a big thing for horses? It must be. They have those lovely nostrils.
They're amazing. Yeah. Back to your last question. Also, I noticed when I first got Gloria, my dog, I already had Maddie. And she's just a very different dog from any other dog I've had. And incredibly bright and street savvy. And she needs a different kind of direction from most dogs I've ever known. So I watched myself try to use horse language with her because I was trying to solve problems with her behavior right away that I hadn't contended with my other dogs. So I saw really fast that I was way too big with her, that I let my energy get big. And she's a small creature. She's not, 10 times my size or more like the horses are. But the subtlety of body language and most importantly, that skill of just being really crisp with my communication, like this is it. We're not negotiating. We're not arguing. Through literally just like, we're moving now. Do, 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 do. That has been so very, very helpful. And then of course, translate that to like a kitty.
Or a child, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So let's go back to Maddie. So how's she doing now? And what are your hopes for her going forward?
She's doing really well. What I hope, my hope for her right now is that she can stay healthy while I'm navigating this part of my life where my mom is in hospice and I'm traveling and very unavailable. So that with my limited availability, that we can do little bits of training to keep her engaged enough. And she's brilliant. She's recognized among other horse owners and my trainer that she's just a really, really bright horse and she wants to do stuff and she wants to work, even though like most organisms, she is by nature designed to enjoy leisure and great food. She really wants relationship and wants to do stuff. So relationship with horses is really doing stuff together, even if that's walking the pasture together. So my hope is that we can refine this and that I can get back into her physical training so she's strong enough for us to ride together, for me to ride her. But that's not the be all and the end all of it for me. I mainly want to go further in our communication skills because I feel like I am at a little scissor right here. I'm at a little pause and I can tell we're trying to go to the next level, but it's going to take a little more time to get there.
I love this idea of a relationship that is ongoing and evolving.
Yeah, they live a long time and when they can live to capacity and I want more for her. I want more for her because I want more for myself with her.
Yeah.
I've been amazed at this love that has unfolded in me for her. When you asked about how I started to identify trust or how I started to be clear that this is not just I want a relationship with this horse. I like having a horse being her person. When I saw that it truly is a relationship that she values also in her horse terms, I saw this love in me that exceeds what I thought possible with somebody that I have such a limited relationship with. Like my cats and dogs and my people, it just feels so easy to understand, but with Maddie, sometimes I see her 10 minutes a day. And still, this love, it seems like it correlates to her size. and to her wildness. Like any animal for me, it feels like a privilege that they'll deal with us, much less love us or invest in us and relate with us. But with a horse, and especially a wild horse, she doesn't have to do this. And she's choosing it, and to see this wild animal wants to be with me, not just because I have something in my pocket or because I'll touch her, but because we know each other. It's just, yeah, I can't even believe how much I love her, because it's just outside my experience, the love for a horse. It feels to me like it is fed by and informed by neurology, horse neurology and human neurology, just how intensely sensitive we can both be. And I've been reading a little bit about, from a heart math perspective, that's something about the electric field that a horse's heart puts out. It's so huge that it is measurable and is so impactful, in part because of that strength. Mm. And that, yeah, when I read that, I just thought this seems so other and unique to me, this flavor of love and quality of what feels like a heart connection.
I'll have more horse stuff for you coming up, as well as the continuation of my discussion of David Abrams' book, The Spell of the Sensuous, with Trevian Stanger. As always, if you would like to support the podcast, please give me a positive rating wherever you listen. Also, I've started In the Weeds Facebook group, where I encourage listeners to post and engage in discussion with me and others on any and all culture-nature topics. Please join.